Thank you so much, Asaf. It's been a while since we had a chance to see each other in person, but this will have to do in the meantime. Between the COVID pandemic and now the war here in Israel, we are sort of stuck with the Zooms and virtual platforms. It is really a true pleasure to join you, and thank you for giving me this opportunity. When we were planning this session, we wanted to cover a topic that we at NGO Monitor cover. We've been studying this and reporting on it and producing reports for years. Little did we know that it will be even more timely given the ongoing attacks by Hamas, the terror organization in Gaza. So, given that we are limited on time and we want to allow the Q&A session, I'll just go straight to our topic. And I'll do so accompanied by a few slides. You don't have to dedicate your full attention to it. There's a lot of information there, but it's always good to have the visuals in. And when it comes to NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that we follow, as they say, a picture tells a thousand words. So let me try to sort of use the current situation to illustrate the phenomenon that we at NGO Monitor follow and study and act upon. So we have an ongoing aggression from the Gaza and from Hamas, over 3,000 rockets fired at the civilians across Israel. And as a response to that, in a act of self-defense, right, Israel has been severely and heavily attacking Hamas in Gaza, that, as many of you know, fires and operates from heavily populated areas. So, and anyways, Gaza is one of the mostly highly dense areas in the world. So there's almost no way of going around it. There have been civilian victims on their end, and disproportionately, as we would read in just about every media outlet, on the Palestinian side. What happens in the next minute, basically, after the Israeli Defense Forces attack Hamas in defense, right, in trying to protect their civilians, is that we see an era of headlines around the globe from the smallest countries like the one I come from, Serbia, that very little is known about the conflict, and of course, all the way to the US, that Israel has to stop and a disproportionate count of civilian victims and the aggression on the Palestinians and the siege over Gaza and so on. And everyone tries to somehow explain the situation or counter or find facts or the arguments. The question that we ask at NGO Monitor is, where does this information come from? Who feeds the journalists with figures, facts, graphs, infographics, names of victims, their backgrounds, stories, comparisons, and so on? And more often than not, we have seen over the last 20 years that so-called human rights and humanitarian non-governmental organizations, NGOs, are the ones, on one hand, reporting and documenting from the ground, and then trying to pitch the information out to the world. They come in different shapes and forms, from the biggest ones like the Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, or the Norwegian Refugee Council, all the way to the small ones that most of the people have never heard of, like Al-Shabaka, and so on. What they do have in common, though, is that they are one of the main stakeholders and main players in any conflict. But when it comes to the Arab-Israeli conflict, definitely one of the main players. Now, Asaf asked me to shed a specific light on the European aspect of this problematic. And that is because most of these organizations enjoy most significant, if not existential, parts of their budgets from governmental funding from Europe, from the EU, the European Union, other European Union's member states, the UN, And a little bit from Australia, Canada, and the US, it depends. During the Trump administration, most of the funding was cut, both to the NGOs as well as to UNRWA, like many of you will probably know. Now we're seeing a lot of talks about at least some of that being reintroduced, but we are not there yet. The majority of the funding comes from Europe taxpayers' money, basically, which is why we try to focus on Europe during this session. Now, in order to understand this phenomenon, we have to understand Europe better. Why is civil society, as we call it, right? Why is it so important? So in the aftermath of the Second World War, European government countries, and Germany, by the way, they said, okay, we have to, on one hand, make sure that we have thriving democracies and vibrant societies, but at the same time, we still want to continue promoting certain values. But let's say in case of Germany, it would not look necessarily good if now Germany, just in the aftermath of the Second World War, started promoting democratic values elsewhere in the world. And from these two places, we have a phenomenon in Europe where a vibrant civil society, NGOs, is being A, created and B, nurtured over the years by the governments themselves, and tremendous responsibility placed on their shoulders to sort of play a complementary role. Basically, the governments in Europe say we will have separate budget lines for development and cooperation and for civil society because we need that complementary voice that will make sure that that the governments are on the right track. So from its onset, it was meant as a good thing. And indeed, NGOs around the world do tremendous things. But over the decades, just like any other industry, this too has been suffering from many vulnerabilities. And the minute we have a conflict-ridden area, such as the one where I am addressing you from, those vulnerabilities become even greater, and the danger that the NGO community or the civil society by and large might be abused by violent or hateful or terror elements becomes even greater. So let's take a look at the numbers, just so you understand the scope of this phenomenon in the world and in Europe. According to OECD, between the years 2010 and 2017, $148.1 billion US dollars was channeled to and through NGOs from 30 main countries providing development aid. In the table, you'll see the countries, but to spare you the burden of looking of zooming in, we're talking about Australia, US, Canada, and New Zealand, and all the European, basically Western and Northern, like more wealthier countries, members of the EU. You will see that the EU, the European Union, alone provided in this period some 8% of the total monies channeled to and through NGOs. And in the years of 2016 and 17, 15% of global aid was distributed to and through NGOs. When we think in these terms, then we understand the scope and the magnitude of the impact that these organizations do and can have, the voice that they're being given, and the platform that they enjoy with such vast budgets. In certain cases, when we talk about bigger organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, we can easily compare their annual budgets to annual budgets of smaller countries in Europe, definitely. If we try to zoom in on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we can see, for example, in the Palestinian context, that according to NGO Monitor estimates, because there's not that much transparency, so not all information is publicly available, but our conservative estimate is that at least $100 million is annually transferred to NGOs that go by the name human rights or humanitarian groups and are in one way or another active in the context of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Now, much has been said about the financial dependence and existential dependence of the Palestinian groups from this foreign aid, basically. And in last summer, in July or June 2020, a Palestinian scholar from the Birzeit University released a study that included a survey amongst 33 Palestinian NGOs, and they ranked European governmental sources as one of the top three, basically, financial sources for their funding. What we see is that many of these groups, instead of promoting human rights and humanitarian causes, they promote BDS and blatant anti-Semitism. They oftentimes incite to violence, and in certain cases have terror ties. And this is what we will focus on today. One thing is for sure, that most of them come with very politicized ideologies and agendas, and they very openly and blatantly lobby against Israel, including, for example, at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So from here, I'll jump straight to our issue, which is the blind spot on terror. I'll start by telling you that it has been at least a decade that we at NGO Monitor have been trying to show, at first, occasional connections between terror groups and certain NGOs, and over the time, more and more visible ones, and we would gather more and more evidence of direct connections, either by board members or by employees, or by mere sharing of, you know, PFLP, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which is a designated terrorist organization in the U.S., Canada, EU, and Israel. So we would see a group of NGOs, Palestinian NGOs, sharing their documents, hosting their events, clearly blatant connections. On the other hand, we would see a PFLP event that would host most leaders and board members of the same NGO. So the connection was very, very clear. We would try to raise awareness on this, and we would usually get the same response from Europe, which is, look, we know PFLP was, this is how they would say, used to be a dangerous terror organization. We know that in the 60s and in the 80s, they committed a few terror attacks, very dangerous ones. They hijacked a plane. But it's been decades now that they're sort of a dormant group, and they turned into a political party, right, in the PA. In Germany, for example, German Ministry of Interior, the issues every year report on internal threats on the soil of Germany, Federal Republic of Germany. And every year, year after year, the report would say, PFLP is active in Germany. We follow their operations here. They organize demonstrations. They are the leaders of, you know, the Al-Quds Day and the Palestine Day, etc. But they do not pose a threat, and here's the key point, to German citizens. And they would just let them be. They would let them operate. Until December 2019. Okay, just before the break of Corona, this is how I divide my time in life, prior to Corona and after Corona. What happened in December 2019 is that the Israeli security forces published in the Israeli media that they have arrested a PFLP cell, terror cell of 50 terrorists that were back then allegedly responsible for a terror attack that took place in August 2019, in which a young girl, 17 years old, Rina Schnerb, was murdered. Rina went on a stroll with her father and her brother, and sadly, she never returned home. Among the 50 that were arrested, the Israeli security forces released this information in the media, at least five senior, current, and former employees of at least three Palestinian NGOs were at that moment, sorry, were senior employees of Palestinian NGOs with clear connections to PFLP even before this, and at the same time were beneficiaries of EU, European grants, and Dutch and Spanish and German. This broke the news, and we saw an immediate opportunity to basically elevate the story and raise and show the elected officials in Europe that PFLP is not such a benign organization. I will not go into details because that we don't want to. That's only part of the story. But throughout 2020, we have led a very aggressive campaign in a few capitals in Europe and in Brussels. And I can say with at least some deal of satisfaction that following these campaigns, the Netherlands, the Dutch government, froze its funding to one of the three NGOs whose senior officials were arrested and opened an investigation. It is still an ongoing investigation. They went public and said that that yes, Dutch taxpayer money was used to pay salaries of the employees that were arrested, but the actual investigation was outsourced to an external agency, and it is still an ongoing one. On the EU level, it was a much more difficult case, but eventually the EU too opened an internal investigation that was labeled from the beginning as an internal to be confidential, but we are working now on trying to get the findings of that to make them public. Now, fast forward from that to less than 2 weeks ago, okay? Less than 2 weeks ago, some 10 days ago, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs announces that the Israeli security forces have uncovered a PFLP NGO network. I mean, we were not surprised, but the fact that now Israeli security forces went public and said that not only some of those were arrested over the murder of Rina Schnurb, but actually they caught one of these groups, the health work committees, that is the name of the Palestinian NGO. They caught their employees basically diverting European taxpayer money, right, through the grants they received to terror-linked activities. This is a tweet, what you see now, by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And this is how they portrayed, this is one of the images that they shared. It says on the left-hand side, save the children, because one of the Palestinian NGOs deals with Palestinian children rights. So they use that one to sort of illustrate how they hide behind a noble cause, you know, and they raise money from the European government.
Olga, sorry to cut you off for a second. We can't see the PowerPoint if you're showing it.
Oh,
it's not showing. Yeah.
Hold on. Let me see. You saw nothing?
I saw nothing.
And now?
Now we can see.
Okay. So
if you want to go back a few slides so we can see, because we missed the slides.
Okay, sorry. So I'll go. You should have told me sooner, but it doesn't matter. What I told you before is just figures. So I'm not you didn't miss anything big time. Here you saw basically an article, a screenshot of an article talking about the murder of Rina Schnurb. And actually the one where I'm talking about the image is the screenshot of a tweet that by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So we're good. We're not much damage. So basically they use this image to illustrate how the Palestinian organizations were hiding behind a noble cause, right? Helping Palestinian children to divert European governmental money to terror activities. Now, Israel arrested four senior employees of that particular NGO that I told you about, accountant, former accountant, procurement manager, and a Spanish citizen who was in charge of fundraising in Europe. And I tell you deliberately what their positions were, because in order to illustrate that we were not talking about, someone who delivers mail to them. We're talking about senior officials dealing with money, raising money, pitching for these NGOs and so on. The NGO was charged for funneling European humanitarian aid to PFLP, amongst others, for producing fictional projects, right? Blowing out reports, submitting false documents, submitting forged authorizations from their bank account and so on, in order to both fund attacks, terror attacks, build up capacity of PFLP, the terror group, subsidize families of PFLP activists and terrorists, pay salaries to their activists, some of them directly employed by the groups, as well as, you know, recruit and in general spread the PFLP ideology. What we see basically is that PFLP has now developed over the last decade or so. It has developed, it has had originally a militant arm, right, a terror arm. It developed a political arm because it's a political party, and now it has an NGO arm, a human rights arm that operates vis-a-vis Europe predominantly, much more than in the States, predominantly Europe, because it feeds into an existing ecosystem in which civil society plays a crucial role, and the European governments deem it extremely important to invest in civil society. I mean, this doesn't come as a total surprise, because after the Oslo agreements, the European governments came and they said, you know, we should help you build a civil society, right? It's NGO sector in Palestine, right? And they said, we will help you do that by both funding, but also, you know, working with you, capacity building, sustainability, because they, as Europeans, one of the main values is basically making sure that the civil society, the broader society, is a vibrant one. Who were the first ones on the Palestinian end to have access to that information? All those that were already involved in decision-making processes, politicians, right? So PFLP activists jumped on the opportunity, and then we saw one by one NGOs being created as sort of platforms for whitewashing, for money laundering. The Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs summoned the ambassadors of European countries that are amongst the donors, and our research shows that between the years of 2014 and 2021, over 200 million euros, that's more a little bit less in US dollars, was transferred to some 8 PFLP-connected NGOs from the European Union, the Netherlands, Sweden, Spain, Germany, France, Denmark, Norway, and Switzerland. Just so you, so we also put that in a perspective, when we say 8 NGOs, this is basically the majority of the biggest and most influential NGOs in the Palestinian civil society. Palestinian civil society maybe has some 30, 40 groups that are really active. So when 8 of those are PFLP connected, then that is that shows how much more the phenomenon is dangerous. We have over the years identified at least 70 connections and PFLP. As I said before, between NGO official board members, employees, etc. I want to now. This is the most alarming thing. We were going to go and have again a full-blown campaign in Europe, and we were receiving a lot of phone calls and emails from the European decision makers immediately as this was released to the public by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But then the war happened, so this is sort of on hold right now. But this will definitely be one of the main things on our agenda moving forward. I do want to broaden up a little bit. We're still focusing on terror links, but I want to talk about Gaza a little bit. And I want to mention also what these and other Palestinian NGOs are doing in the middle of the war that we find ourselves in. I'm just being mindful of the time, but I think I'm still good. So when it comes to Gaza and Hamas, there is that much less transparency and access to information compared to the PA. If in the PA, right, the NGOs are not transparent, but we can find information on the European end, right, by the donor governments, or at least they're very active abroad, they speak on conferences, they speak at parliaments. Gaza is much more secluded, and the NGOs themselves have much less maneuvering space inside of Gaza because of the nature of Hamas's rule. Nevertheless, over the last couple of years, there have been enough affairs and incidents that connect NGOs with terrorists. In 2016, there was a major affair in which an Australian church-based development and humanitarian group, World Vision, was involved in a terror-related scandal. Their Gaza director, Mohammed El-Halabi, was arrested by the Israeli security forces and accused of diverting over 60% of World Vision Gaza's budget over 10 years to Hamas. And over 10 years, the amount that was diverted, according to Israeli security forces, amounted to $50 million. Immediately following this, Australia, Germany, and UK, who were amongst the funders of World Vision, froze their funding, and an investigation was opened. We had several other incidents in which different officials of UN agencies operating in Gaza were accused and convicted of diverting aid to Hamas and helping militant causes. And if we think about it from a bird perspective, from a bigger picture perspective, it sort of makes sense even more than in the context of the Palestinian Authority. Because in a situation, in a reality such as the one we have in Gaza, where there is almost no influx of anything, goods, into the Gaza Strip, except for humanitarian aid, right? And supplies that are qualified as humanitarian, it does not come as a total surprise that the humanitarian aid will be so vulnerable and will be used and abused by Hamas for raising funds and diverting them. On top of that, Hamas also has a very developed sort of charity structure where they raise money, and a lot of the population, especially the younger ones, they feel like Hamas is representing them much more than the PA, because they are fighting the Israeli occupation with arms and are less cooperative than the PA. I want to give you another example. Just tell me, do you hear any noise in the background right now?
A little background, but you're fine. Yeah, a little bit.
Am I fine? Okay. Yeah. So I'll give you another example coming from Gaza, so you understand the picture that we paint by putting the bits and pieces of the information we find out there. What you see in front of you is an example of another Palestinian Gaza-based group called, not by coincidence, Red Crescent Society for the Gaza Strip. Make no mistake, it has nothing to do with the actual Red Crescent. They deliberately use the Red Crescent so as to create an illusion that they are connected to the Red Cross or the Red Crescent, but they are not. This is just another NGO based in Gaza that runs a multitude of programs, including programs that promote women rights and help women cope with trauma or domestic violence and so on. But at the same time, these are the type of images that they share on their Facebook while hosting PFLP events. So So we see very clear indications and proof that terror elements are definitely more and more over the years using the civil society and the whole human rights and humanitarian platform to A, raise money from governmental sources, because it is not only Europe, you have to add to that also the United Nations, which is a huge donor, a platitude of church groups, of local NGOs in each of the European countries that also get money from their respective governments, but then choose their own partners here. And all these monies is being basically funneled to the same handful of Palestinian NGOs. Let's take a look, and with this we will slowly bring it to the conclusion. Let's take a peep sort of at what these groups have been doing and saying over the past couple of days since the war with Gaza started with Hamas. And this is by no means a new phenomenon. Every time there is an incident or a war, we see that the NGOs are the first ones on the ground. They collect information, they report, but they're also the first ones to distort the information. We see a pattern where they report on incidents, but they raise the terror links. So for example, a Palestinian organization such as PCHR, which is Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and Al-Mazan, only last week they reported about an Israeli airstrike in which a man and his 15-year-old son were killed. But in their report, they forgot to mention that this person was a Hamas militant and that even his 15-year-old son was buried wearing Hamas uniform, which, you know, we could even talk about child abuse by recruiting a 15-year-old to be a militant. And at the same time, we see them running two parallel narratives. On their website in English that target international audiences, they talk about disproportionality and they report on civilian victims with special emphasis on children. But and on their websites in Arabic, we see an actual accurate reporting where they do mention, as opposed to the English version, that the same 8 children that they reported on were killed by a Hamas rocket that fell short of Israeli territory. As you may know, an estimate is that around 1/5 of Hamas rockets never reach Israel, rather fall inside of Gaza. I want to give you a taste of non-terror linked activities of the NGOs. We are mainly talking about visuals, so it will not be too heavy on information. But take a look at this. This is Amnesty International sponsoring a speaking tour by Bassem Tamimi in 2015 in the US. Bassem Tamimi is Manal Tamimi's father. Manal Tamimi was the cute girl, Palestinian girl, who was arrested for throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. And surrounding that, there was a huge campaign around the world against Israel for arresting her. And following that, her father, Bassem Tamimi, is brought to the U.S. on a speaking tour, amongst other, talking to third graders in New Jersey, where he spoke about the oppression, the occupation, and then he called them to be freedom fighters for Palestine. Third graders. He shared the image that you see here is an image that he shared on his Facebook, in which he accused Israel for harvesting Palestinian children's organs in order to sell them on black market and so on. Let's take a look at another example from last summer. In the midst of the COVID affair, Oxfam UK. Oxfam is one of the biggest European church, the Christian humanitarian groups that both enjoys heavy governmental funding from UK and Netherlands and Scandinavian countries, as well as has an aggressive fundraising campaign from citizens, and on their in their online shop, they were offering Mein Kampf for £8, just like that. And when we sent them a letter, they took it down, and they said that this was due to a technical error by one of the employees. Palestinian Medical Relief Society, another group that claims to be a complementary medical services provider to Palestinian population, given that they don't have access to proper medical care. And in one of their annual reports, instead of reporting on the poor medical system, state of the art, they shared Latouf's caricatures, and I truly here don't need to add anything. The Holocaust metaphors speak for themselves. Another one, as you can see, Manal Tamimi, who was announced a UN human rights defender in 2017. What you see in front of you is only a selection of her tweets that feature anything from blatant hate towards Israel all the way to the most blatant anti-Semitism, calling to wipe out Israel, to kill all Zionists, and so on. I'll finish with a few words of what is it that we at NGO Monitor do about all this. So we produce the reports, but we don't finish with that. We try to raise awareness with the governments and the elected officials in all the donor governments with two main action items. One is a more immediate one. In case we have solid evidence that a certain NGO grantee of that government is promoting violent narratives, anti-Semitism, BDS, or has ties to terror, with a request for that government to immediately defund that organization. And over the last 10 years, our research has led to cuts of more than $53 million in funding to such NGOs. But at the same time, and I always emphasize that this is probably the more important aspect of what we call for, because it's a lasting one, we call for governments to change their policies on how they engage with civil society, how they engage with NGOs. Working with NGOs is not a bad thing. There's plenty of human rights and humanitarian groups who do outstanding work and truly complement the work or reach out to areas that no government official could or can. But at the same time, just like any industry, this one is also vulnerable, and we call them to implement more stringent vetting procedures, more robust control systems to ensure that the taxpayers' money is not abused by hateful, violent, and terror elements, such as in cases that I presented to you today. And with this, Asaf, I think I will finish. I think I have shared more than enough information, and I look forward to a discussion and any questions that you might have.
Wonderful. Thank you for that, Olga, and thank you for all the work you guys are doing at NGO Monitor. The work you're doing is invaluable, and the reports that you've been producing have been tremendous for all of us in the space as far as actual data, and so it's always a pleasure to partner together. Let me, given the time, let's start with, I want to open up the floor to as many questions as we have. So the floor is now open. If you have your questions, you can either type them in or raise your virtual hand. Alex, why don't you start us off with your first question, and then I'll read the next questions as we, given the, what we have as far as time-wise.
Sure. So let me thank you for the presentation and for the work that you do. I want to go back briefly to the European scene. Civil society, this concept of civil society, is very much a kind of civil religion in Europe, one that is dominated by state institutions and by the European Union, which has brought in churches and unions and various municipalities and which then go about funding NGOs which purport to promote civil society around the world. So I want to ask about local political accountability. We know the work that NGO Monitor does, but what happens at the grassroots level in Europe? Are there European entities that are watchdogs such as yourself? And what are the mechanisms that local Europeans are doing to push back against these kinds of abuses in the Israeli, the Arab-Israeli or Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or more broadly about how their money as Europeans and residents of various states are is being spent?
So it's many questions in one, actually. And yes, you call it righteously civil society religion. I try to be kinder when I explained how important, how pivotal of a role the civil society plays in Europe. And that's sort of the main challenge with this issue. When we approach the decision, when we approach the administrations in Europe, we are almost automatically welcomed with antagonism, because this, so as you called it, NGO religion, allows for the NGOs to do no wrong, right? A human rights group can only do good. And the minute that the European government entrusted a certain group with partnership with them and has been working with them for years, no administration in Europe is just simply going to say, oh, thank you for the information, now let us take a look at it, because the partner we've been working with for the last 10 years, we're just going to scrutinize them and stop working with them. On the contrary, the automatic response is almost always denying any such things, any connection, you know, accusing us of being partisan or political or pro-Israel, as if there was a pro-Israel or anti-Israel aspect to terror links, right? If anything, I always try to argue in Europe that before it becomes harmful to Israel, this is first and foremost a major betrayal of the Palestinian people. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars are being poured into these organizations that are supposed to mend their society. They are supposed to deal with really important issues like children rights, women rights, abuse in family, building a democratic society. And instead of doing that, the money is being funneled to harm Israel in one way or another, either ideologically or through funding terror activities or terror-linked activities. The way that a discourse is, however, created in Europe, because we have seen a significant change in narratives over the last 5 to 10 years, is by approaching elected officials, members of the parliament, and by working very hard to have local media, so not only Israeli media, but local media in Europe, write about these issues, because that's when it resonates with them. And over the years, we have seen more and more readiness to address this, partially because there has been more and more proof. I have to say that also we have been trying to bring to the forefront examples that are outside of the Arab-Israeli conflict in order to underline that this is not an ideological discussion. It is a much broader discussion of no one can be entrusted blindly with such amount, definitely and most certainly not in conflict-ridden areas. Now, you asked about local watchdogs. There is no other group that does the work that NGO Monitor does. Having said that, meaning collect all the information and aggregating them in reports and so on. However, the way we promote this information and raise information with elected officials is both ourselves, but we are based in Israel, so we are cognizant of the limitations that we have in any one country. So we partner with local organizations, Jewish, not Jewish, any stakeholder that might be interested, because when this case is made by a German citizen on the topic of how German taxpayer money is spent, then that case is that much more that much stronger than when it when it's being made by an Israeli watchdog. I hope that answers your question.
Wonderful. So let me also thank you for that, Alex, as well, and thank you for your response, Olga. Let me try to combine some of the questions with the time that we have and see what I can, you know, combine them. So I'm going to try to combine Barry's question, Barry Warner, and Avi Green's question. And so they're asking about, and I'm adding to this as well. So given the fact that, you know, Europe understands anti-Semitism for what it is, and somewhat better than in other places around the world. You know, we, you know, we debate here in the States as far as free speech and when anti-Semitism plays into all of this. Can you touch on the fact that when Europe understands a group as to be an NGO is an anti-Semite, and they're facilitating terrorist groups? You know, how does the actual action take place to stop them, you know, when they understand what this actually means. And this is also, you know, related, you know, to Avi's question, you know, so if they understand, you know, the problem for what it is, are there legal measures that we can do to stop the funding as far as, you know, and how they understand where the money is coming from and the funding groups? And obviously we I know you guys have been working hard to make sure that, you know, Hamas is seen for what Hamas is, Hezbollah is seen for what Hezbollah is, but, you know, obviously the charity element gives it a kind of a diplomatic immunity, so to speak. But, you know, maybe you want to talk about those two issues if you can.
So another multifaceted question. So I think you're giving Europe a little bit too much credit when you say that Europe understands anti-Semitism. Europe, in my view, understands old school anti-Semitism, because that is the anti-Semitism with which it feels comfortable. And I will explain what I mean. In a sense that it feels comfortable combating far-right anti-Semitism that is identified with neo-Nazis and fascists and extreme right groups. It feels comfortable combating anti-Semitism that, you know, in which a Jew is attacked because he wears, you know, identifiable Jewish clothes or symbols and so on. And it feels comfortable in preserving the memory of Holocaust by extrapolating its universal message onto other genocides. Roma persecution in Europe, you know, Rwanda, name it, anyone. Where it does not feel comfortable the least, and I think with all the, I'm trying to choose my words very carefully because everything in the US right now is a sensitive issue, but with the polarization inside of the US society right now, I still claim this with the responsibility that in the US there is much more of a discourse about the anti-Israel or the Israel-motivated anti-Semitism. Europe is much less comfortable discussing anti-Semitism that is connected to Israel or Zionism. For many years, it was not capable of doing that at all. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition on anti-Semitism changed that a little bit, because the examples attached to the working definition deal with Israel-related anti-Semitism, and they stipulate exactly what constitutes. So questioning Israel's right to exist is to be deemed as anti-Semitic. Calling Israel an apartheid state is to be seen as anti-Semitic, holding it to double standards, holding a local Jewish community collectively responsible for the actions of the Israeli government and so on and so on. But between this and actual ministries or administration or municipalities, right, or different branches of the government implementing it, there is still a very, very long way. Now, once there is a proof that that an NGO promoted anti-Semitism, and anyone, is it us or be it another organization, raises the, you know, shows that and raises the awareness, there's very few mechanisms in place that know how to deal with this. And by the way, the same is the case with terror when it comes to NGOs. The PFLP is officially on EU's terror list. But unlike ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any other terror organization that is on that list, PFLP has not a single individual attached to it. So basically, in legal terms, European countries have no tools to implement this because they cannot impose sanctions on PFLP. It's never PFLP, you know, right, from with its headquarters. It's Leila Khaled, who is a bona fide PFLP terrorist who hijacked the plane. It is her that travels to Europe and is hosted at a European Parliament in Brussels as a keynote speaker and gets standing ovations. And even when made alert, the EU officials would say to you, but we have no legal ground to prevent this from happening because any member of the European Parliament is free to invite anyone who is not on the terror list, and she is not. More than that, I mean, this just goes, when it comes to NGOs, this becomes even more blurry. Now, we have, the world or Israel have waged a big victory only a few weeks ago. For example, European Union, European Parliament passed a resolution in which it basically calls for the EU to both retroactively and moving forward sanction all NGOs with clear ties to terror organizations, and they elaborate board members, affiliation, activities, employees, and so on. It calls for retracting the funds that were already given to such organization, as well as to making them non-eligible for future funding. Now, this is a major milestone because nothing remotely similar to this has ever been adopted in any European country. And now the challenge is with us to push for, to make sure that this is actually implemented, which is sometimes as difficult as getting a decision like this to be adopted.
Great, thank you. And just to be clear, I wasn't making sure that, you know, that Europe is fully there, but there have been a lot of measures taken in Europe that, you know, we've not been able to see here in the States. I mean, these are all comparative terms, and obviously within today's world of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and free speech, these are all the things that play into the conversation.
And by the way, if I can just add a sentence, speaking about the European Union, in early January, so right after the New Year's, European Parliament released a handbook on practical use and implementation of the IRA working definition on anti-Semitism, and it identified four sectors of the society that need to implement it in practice. That is the police, right, the security forces, education, the judiciary system, and civil society, NGOs. So you know, now that it's a constant battle. There is movement, there is positive steps that are being taken, and we just have to continue pushing.
Right, and that's a good point, and that actually relates to the question that Ralph had about, you know, how do we make sure that we abate the framework by creating some kind of measures as far as, you know, when one shuts down, one opens up, how do you prevent that from happening? You know, and if these, you know, and these guidelines are taking place, is there a way, you know, on that note, are all these issues being enforced now, you know, but, you know, or are they just recommendations, I mean, legally wise, as far as, you know, these things taking place?
Well, when the resolution I mentioned in the European Parliament on terror affiliation between NGOs, that is a legally binding decision that was adopted. There was a big battle behind the scenes. European Parliament is a very complex system. Every political group has to agree on every line of that resolution, and the resolution is basically a lengthy commentary on the spendings of the European Union for the previous year. But it was adopted, and the European Commission, which is the executive arm of the European Union, will have to act upon it. It will have to report on it at the end of next year. So we will see how much movement there will be coming from the European Commission. In political terms, many of you know, we talk about years-long processes. So there are no quick results here. Most of our battles are that long-term and long-run battles. But I think that one thing is for sure, and this is how we try to work on these issues, and that is to make sure that at least as much as possible, right, ensure that there's a bipartisan in US context or in European context, multi-partisan support for these issues. There's always going to be one or two political parties in any one country that will not want to even take a meeting with us because ideologically they're not even open to listening to what we have to say. But how we phrase our messages does make a difference. And if we can appeal to more central and even center-left parties in European countries, that helps a lot, because that is then seen as an issue that of a broader consensus, rather than only if it's picked up by you know, clear pro-Israel voices, especially that in Europe over the last couple of years has nothing to do with Israel, but it is being manifested in such way that there's a lot of far-right political parties who take defense of Israel as one of their official agendas. And then very often, they even harm the work that is being done with other political parties because they paint it in, you know, radical colors. And they make our job that much more difficult.
Great. So I'm just being cognizant of our time, and I think we have time for one more question. And again, I apologize in advance for not getting to everybody's questions today. I know Olga's in a different time zone, and some of us are West Coast and East Coast time zones. So again, if we don't get to your question today, please feel free to email us after. But let me give Andrew Lim the last question, and this is obviously kind of a segue from your last point. Is there a grid? Or have you been able to identify, I guess, within the work you guys have been doing, European institutions and government that are actually more cooperative than others? So if you bring it to there, you know, there's a kind of a more of a, I'm adding here, kind of a more of a trickle down effect. If it happens there as a standard, is there a better chance of adopting it throughout the EU at large, you know, in the way that, you know, you're deciding where to kind of position the efforts of the work that's being done?
It depends largely on the current constellation of the ruling government or ruling coalition in any one European country. And if it's a very left-leaning government, then the interest and the readiness to pick up these issues will be very modest, let's put it that way. But if it's a centrist right government, the elected officials will be much more prone and interested to address these issues and will be much more vested, right, to engage with them. I can tell you that over the past 4 years alone, we have seen a specific tangible change in funding to NGOs policies in the EU, Switzerland, Denmark, the Netherlands, Germany, Norway. So on one hand, you have a country like Denmark that the minute that their elected officials and administration were made aware that a lot of their funding was going to terror-linked organizations or BDS, etc. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs introduced specific guidelines, which is probably the best policy solution one can think of. Because a law, we generally at NGO Monitor, we do not advocate for legislation, because the legislation, A, is an extremely lengthy political and policy tool, but also by its definition is restrictive. So you are addressing one thing, but you're A, inviting another legislation proposal from an opposing party, but as well, there are very few legislation that can encompass, you know, the entire phenomenon, especially a phenomenon that is so, I don't know, soft. Let's call it soft, you know, to identify. So the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs introduced specific guidelines saying Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs will not fund NGOs that promote BDS, period. Will not fund NGOs that promote anti-Semitism, period. Will not fund NGOs whose members are involved or active in EU-designated terror organizations, period. Very simple. And they have done that very quickly. Other governments, like Germany, are very big on declarations. So the Bundestag, the German parliament, has adopted a resolution condemning BDS and calling for fight against anti-Semitism. And in the resolution, they even mentioned NGOs, right? But they haven't really done anything to act upon it. And this happened almost 4 years ago now, or 3 years ago. And the same is the case with Switzerland. Switzerland passed the legislation that says Swiss money will not go to organizations that promote hate speech, anti-Semitism, or have violent agendas. But they are still struggling on how to implement it, especially that Switzerland, as a non-EU member, is not... does not subscribe to the EU terror list, and they don't have their own terror list. In Switzerland, even Hamas is not a designated terror organization, let alone PFLP. Now, at the same time, and this is probably the best, as good of an answer as I will give you on this question, is that the more countries move on this issue, the more countries will join. No, the toughest one was the first one to get them to move. But when we can show that 7 or 8 European countries, including the EU, has introduced now new policies on how to engage with the civil society, other countries feel more compelled to act on this issue as well. When you add to that the fact that the European Court of Auditors, which is the main auditing body of the European Union, issued a full-blown report 2 years ago on how the EU is clueless on how it spends money through NGOs, then it becomes I compare it to a snowball. You know, once you set it free, as it continues to roll down the hill, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually it picks up on everyone and anyone who is on its way.
Wonderful. Olga, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for your excellent presentation and for all the information. There's obviously a lot to unpack now, and it's great to see you. Hopefully we get to see each other in person at some point in the near future, and hopefully everybody is staying safe and calm in your house and everybody in Israel as well. I want to thank everybody for attending, of course, as always, this afternoon. You know, I know that there were a lot more questions we did not get to. And of course, please feel free to email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org. I want to thank Alex, as always, for joining me, for helping out with the conversation. Please be on the lookout for future conversations and webinars that will be coming shortly. And I wish everybody, I hope everybody's staying safe and healthy and wherever you guys are. And we will continue the conversation soon. So. Thank you very much, Olga, and we will talk soon.
Thank you very much, Asaf, for having me, and thank you, everyone.